Thank you for listening to Torah Media Atlanta. Won't you consider making a donation to help support this important work? Just go to TorahMediaAtlanta.com and click on the donate link. Thank you very much.
It is January the 9th, and we should say that it is also 2011, because that way we'll know when we finish Shmos. In four short years, we'll know exactly when we started. We are beginning Sefer Shmos, which we're calling, we've changed from our class of creation to our class of redemption. And it is on page 292 in the Sefer Chumash. Now, the first question is, why are we calling it the Book of Redemption?
Redeemed in like the second chapter.
Okay, so because we're redeemed in this book, in this Sefer. And, yeah.
What exactly does redeem mean?
Ah, okay, good. That's a good question. What does redeem mean? Okay. Our sages, Chazal, give the book of Shemos the name Sefer HaGeula, the book of redemption. Geula, like we say in Davening, we say Goal Yisrael, that he redeemed the Jews. I don't know what it exactly means in English, meaning that I don't know if it's a perfect translation, but the word in Hebrew seems to refer to taking someone out of out of the control of others. It seems to be that is a redemption. So we take them out of the control of others. And here, of course, we were redeemed from Mitzrayim, from Paro. Now, what is interesting is that the book begins with the slavery. As we know, we ended off Sefer Bereishis with the Jews in Egypt and being firmly ensconced in Egypt, and with Yosef's death, but no slavery as of yet. We know that there's going to be slavery that was already foretold at the Bris Bein HaBesarim, the covenant between the halves, between Hashem and Abraham, way back in Parshas Lech Lecha. So we know there's going to be some form of slavery, even had you not read the Chumash before and never experienced the Pesach Seder. But if you're just reading the Chumash from the beginning until here, you would know that there is going to be an impending slavery. So we know it's coming. The slavery does take up a few chapters here, as we will discuss, but a description of the slavery. But already in the second chapter, there are the seeds of redemption, and certainly once we get to the end of this of Shmos, we start Parshas Va'era. We're already into redemption. And redemption takes up much more of the book than slavery. What is going to be tricky here is to keep in mind that the entire book is the book of redemption. Not just the parashos that we've been reading the past few Shabbatos with the 10 plagues. This coming Shabbat we have Parshas Beshalach, which is going to be the splitting of the sea and how the Egyptians are drowned. But then there's going to be several parashios that deal with receiving the Torah and building the Mishkan, building the tabernacle, the sin of the golden calf. And all of this is going to take place in the book of Shemos, which is Sefer HaGeula, the book of redemption. So what we're going to have to do as we go through the Sefer, and the beginning won't be difficult, but once we get to the second half of the book of Shemos, the book of redemption, we're going to have to understand why is it called the book of redemption, even though really the second half, there's no more mention of the Egyptians. They're gone. They're drowned. So why is it still called the book of redemption, even as we are moving into the stories of the receiving of the Torah and also the building of the Mishkan, the tabernacle?
We have to get into the land.
Well, we don't get into the land until the end of the Chumash. We have three more books to go after this one.
But we did that before that. It's all a repeat.
Well, it's not all a repeat. I mean, it's not all. There is a. Hello. Sorry. Come on in. So, yeah, there's still one chair over here. So we still have a lot to go after they're actually redeemed. But this is a question which we're going to have to deal with when we get to the stories of the receiving of the Torah and the Mishkan and the building of the tabernacle. Evidently, those things also have to do with redemption. And we're going to have to see how that works.
Okay.
Yeah.
Allison redemption has two components to it, the physical redemption and the spiritual redemption.
Okay, okay.
Because physically being removed from a crime, a slave, but spiritually to elevate ourselves up later to Martin Tom and everything else.
Okay, so you're suggesting there's more to redemption than simply not working for somebody else. Not being under the thumb of somebody else. There's more to it than that. And you're suggesting that true redemption requires more than just removing the shackles of slavery. There's more to it.
Yeah, because when we leave Mitzrayim, we take upon ourselves the yoke of Shemayim. We make Hashem our Melech.
Okay.
So rather than being slaves to Pharaoh, we become Luke's of Hashem's kingship.
Okay. Okay, which begs the question, why is that called redemption? Is it redemption if he takes a slave away from his master and give him another master? Is that redemption?
Because we have free will at that point, because Hashem gives us free will to serve him or not.
Okay.
Now we get the Torah, which is the whole purpose of the creation of the world, is to give Christ all, the name of the Torah.
Okay, okay. So these are issues which are going to come. We're going to have to deal with it. We're going to have to deal with this extensively as we move along in the book of Shemot. The beginning, as I said, is not difficult. The beginning is clear. We're going to deal with slavery and immediately deal with redemption. That is easy to deal with, and those are the stories that we're very familiar with, which we tell over at the Seder every year. The beauty of what we're going to be learning now, and it will take several months before, maybe longer, before we get through the beginning of the book over here, the beauty of it is that the Pesach Seder, which we do relive every year, deals with these parts of the Chumash. And whatever we learn now, starting with the beginning of Shemot and going all the way through, including B'Shalach, all the way through these first several parashios, with all the 10 plagues, etc., are everything that we study and talk about will be relevant to the Pesach Seder. So our Pesach Seder should be enhanced by what we're learning now through until Pesach this year. The truth is, until Pesach next year, likely we will still be dealing with Pesach-type discussions. So that's the beauty of it. Our Seders should all be better off once we've gone through this. Another important observation to make over here, and by way of introduction, is that the book is called Sefer Shemos. Now, why is it called Sefer Shemos? Because Shemos is the second word in the book. It's Be'ilah Shemos. What does the word Shemos mean?
Names.
These are the names of the Jewish people. And the Torah proceeds to mention the names of Yaakov and his 12 sons, the 12 tribes.
Which repeats itself because we had them.
That's true. We had it already before, and it repeats itself here.
So, I just wanted to ask a question.
Yeah.
Why is it Shemos? Feminine when the names are all masculine names.
I mean, why is the plural Shemos in that form? The way that Hebrew nouns work and they become plural with the suf ending or the mem ending does not necessarily reflect what the word means. It's a feminine word or masculine word, just as you have in other languages as well. You can have different feminine words and masculine words. I'll tell you a very interesting thing that. Well, first, so for example, the word kelev, which means dog, is a masculine word. But that's true no matter what kind of dog you're talking about. It doesn't matter what gender of dog you're talking about. It's a masculine word. The word kelev is a noun, is a masculine noun, just as the word shulchan, table, is a masculine noun. And so too, there are feminine nouns which could refer to a male gender. It doesn't follow what it's talking about. It rather refers to the type of word that it is. There's an interesting story that happened. There was once a debate. There was a debate amongst schools, Jewish schools in America, whether in the middle part of the 20th century, there was a discussion whether they should teach in English, or should they teach only in Ivrit. Today, there are schools that teach only in Ivrit, but it was a real debate in the middle part of the 20th century. It was a major debate whether that should be the language taught in. So Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky, at that time, said that regardless whether the best way to teach is in Hebrew or in English, but if the teacher's natural language is English, then they should not teach in Hebrew. They should teach in the language that they are most familiar with. And he bolstered this with a book that he had seen. He had seen a book that was written in Russia, and it was written by Jews in Russia to teach a subject to the Russian Jewish children. And it was written by a Jewish Zionist who felt that they should teach in Hebrew. They should teach in Hebrew. So he wrote in the book, there was a story in the book about a stork and a fox. A stork and a fox. That was, you know, it was a children's story about a stork and a fox. In the story, the stork was male and the fox was female. The stork was male, and that's the way it was depicted. You know, a male stork having a dialogue with a female fox. So Rav Yaakov Simon, he saw the story, it troubled him, because the Hebrew word for stork is chasida. Chasida is a feminine noun. The Hebrew word for fox is shu'ol. Shu'ol is a masculine noun. So it bothered Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky, why would, if you're writing a book in Hebrew, why would you depict the stork as being male and the fox as being female, when in fact the nouns are the reverse? And then he realized that the reason why this person wrote the book this way is because in Russian, it's the other way around. The word for stork in Russian is a masculine noun, and the word for fox in Russian is a feminine noun. And so the author of the book, who was trying to teach Hebrew, couldn't get out of his own head the natural association of the male, the masculine and feminine nouns. So that was one of his reasons why he said that a person should teach in their natural language, because it's very difficult to superimpose another language on somebody. So at any rate, you brought up the word here of Shemos. The name itself is the noun itself is a feminine noun. Feminine, Shemos, that's why it's Shemos.
The plural.
The plural, right. It's a feminine type plural. Right.
But the
name, the word itself. Well, the name itself it does sound like a masculine noun, but the way that it's pluralized is in that way.
Like shulchan is a har, but the feminine, but the plural is feminine.
It was shulchan. Correct. That's a good point. Shulchanos. You're right. Sometimes it does end up with the above stuff. That's a good point.
But you're saying the word shame.
No. You're correct. I said it incorrectly. You're correct. But the word shame also is really, it sounds more like a masculine noun, but the way it's pluralized, and this is really what Dottie is asking, is that rough stuff. Yeah, that's a good point. Now, in other words, we're not answering your question. So now, why would the book of Shemos, of redemption, Sefer HaGeula, be called Shemos, names? Why would it be that way? Now, it's true, it's the second word in the book, but that's not coincidental. Why would Hashem have the book that is the book of redemption be called the book of names? What do names have to do with redemption?
That's who he was redeeming. The people, the followers of the tribes, and that was their name.
Okay, so these are the names of the people who were being redeemed.
But based on the ancestor you have, the redeemer.
You mean the names of the people who are the ancestors that are listed over here, right? Not the people themselves who are being redeemed. They're not, no longer living. That's true.
And it also the sons from the nation of Israel.
True. But it still doesn't explain why it's called the Book of Names. It seems that names have to do with redemption.
Because there's a lot of important names, Moshe.
That doesn't explain why it should be redemption.
Well, the hand. I think, okay. Emma.
Because when you're in a state of slavery, you do not really have a name, and you have to be redeemed in order to
to have a status of being an individual.
Okay.
Have a name.
Okay, that's a nice
then
answer.
Then you have a name.
Okay. So a slave does not have an identity of his own. A slave is nothing more than an expression of the master. The slave, he doesn't think for himself. The slave doesn't make decisions for himself. The slave does as he is told to do. That's the nature of a slave. A slave does not have a personality, a personal identity. By being redeemed, then a person has a name. A person has an identity. A name is your identity. That's who you are. That's true whether the name is some kind of a nonsense name. Then it's true. It's still your identity. It's who you are. But we believe it even more strongly because we know that when parents give a child a name, then they are imbued with a special divine inspiration that they give a name that actually defines the essence of the child. And every name that we carry, our Jewish names that we carry, define our own essence, each one of us. And so that it can only be with a person who is not a slave. It's a person who is able to make their own choices and their own decisions. Then they have an identity. So that would explain why redemption and names are so intertwined. One of the things that we know the Jews did not change when they were in Egypt is their names. That was one of the things that they held on to, even as the Jews assimilated into the Egyptian culture. But one of the things they refused to give up was their names. They kept their Jewish names. And that was a way of holding on to their identity as Jews. They would not allow themselves to become Egyptian to the point where you could no longer discern between Jew and Egyptian. There's another reason why the book of redemption of Geula would be called Shemos, would be called names. We say in davening that about Hashem, we say Mona Mispar Lakol Chagim, he gives a count to the stars, L'chulam Shemos Yikra. To all of them, he calls a name. Hashem not only counts the stars, but all the billions of stars that are out there, he has a name for each and every one. And you know the star registry, the International Star Registry. You can pay to have a star named. Right? But the amount of stars that are out there are so many stars, there are more stars out there than people. It's no big deal to name a star. So the Hashem has a name for each and every star. Now, what does it mean he has a name for each and every star? What does that mean? Hashem sits there naming, you know, there's George and there's, you know, Clara. And so what does that mean? He's naming the stars? What does he have to do with naming the stars? So if Hashem names the stars, what that means is that each star has an identity, which means that all the billions of stars that are out there, they each serve a function. Hashem didn't just create stars because he just felt like, you know, filling up the sky and just go, oh, you got to have another billion stars, another several billion stars. Hashem has a use for each and every star in the sky, which seems impossible. But if Hashem made it, it must have a purpose. There's no such thing as something that Hashem created for no purpose. If he created it, it has a purpose. And so each and every star has a name, which means it has an essence, it has a reason for being. That's true of the stars. It's true of the sand. Each and every speck of sand has a purpose for being. Each and every blade of grass has a purpose for being. They're not haphazard. Each and every insect has a purpose for being. Hashem names the stars because they each have a purpose for being. When Hashem says that we have names, the Jews have names, what that means is that we each have a purpose for existing. We each bring something to the table that no one else can, each and every one of us. This is true for all of creation and all of humanity, but it is more so for the Jews than anybody else. As we've talked about many, many times, the Jews occupy center stage in creation. And as a result, each and every Jew serves a purpose, brings purpose to the world that no one else can. This is both empowering and it's sobering. It's empowering because we should know that we are all valuable. Each and every one of us brings purpose to the world. We each have a purpose to serve. On the other hand, it's sobering because if we are here for a reason, each and every one of us, and if my job can't be done by you and your job can't be done by me or anybody else, then we better make sure to do our job. Because if one of us lives 120 years and leaves this world and doesn't do their job, that job simply doesn't get done. That means there is something lacking that should have been. We each have a name, and that name is purpose. Hashem took us out of Egypt so that we could each fulfill our purpose. As long as we were under the Egyptian rule, we could not fulfill our purpose. We were subjected and therefore unable to fulfill our purpose. By being redeemed and given the Torah, etc., we now have the ability to fulfill our purpose. And this is in part the answer to the question we started with, which is why not only is getting out of slavery called redemption, but also receiving the Torah and also building the Mishkan, building the tabernacle, because it is the purpose in life, which is what we were given when we were redeemed. It's not simply, now you're free, go party, right? It wasn't that. It was, now you are free, now fulfill your purpose. That's the purpose of the freedom, is that we can fulfill our purpose.
Isn't name English a form of endearment?
Okay, good, good. That's true.
Because Hashem, named Yaakov and your son, is the purpose to me, but Leo counted it because Hashem loves us. He doesn't want to count us. So maybe it also shows endearment, how he loves us.
Okay. So there is that as well. That's a very good point Mrs. Darkman is mentioning, that using a person's name is a form of endearment. You can tell the difference between a pet owner that loves their pet or that simply has their pet for whatever practical purpose. A farmer has many animals, and not every animal has a name. Usually the cows had a name, right? But I don't think that the farmer would name every single animal that he had. I don't know if every chicken had a name. I don't know if because the ones that were regularly, they were gone through very quickly and so they didn't, but the ones that were there as a fixture, so a cow would give milk for a long period of time, so that was one that had a name. But those animals that were, our watchdog had a name because that was one they kept for a long time. But an animal that was just cycled through, that was slaughtered and cycled through or sold, so it wouldn't necessarily be given a name. There's a certain endearment to something which is going to be kept for a long time. And people name their pets because they have a connection with their pets. When you use a person's name, so typically it is a form of endearment. Of course, they were using a person's name like calling a child, Yanko! That's not necessarily endearment. But usually it's endearment. This is also that is true. That would be the use of the word shemos, names. I do want to point out to you that this is why also you find often that I have an aversion to refer to women by their first names, and that's because other than my wife, of course, and my daughters. So that's because of creating a barrier, since there should be a clear separation between men and women, and we converse with each other, we're in a class together, but in order to maintain that sense of separation, that is why I generally, and it's not always, but I generally refrain from using a woman's first name. It presents a certain distinction, a certain barrier. Using a first name has a sense of endearment to it, which should not necessarily be present between a man and a woman who are not related. That's the same idea, because using a name has a sense of endearment. So let us begin the book of Shmos. We say, again, on 292. Ve'ela Shmos Bnei Yisrael Habayim Mitzrayim. These are the names of the Bnei Yisrael, the Jews, coming to Egypt. Es Yaakov Ishu Vesobo. With Yaakov, each man and his household came. Reuven, Shimon, Levi, Yehuda. Yisachar, Zevulun, Uvinyamin. Dan, Naphtali, Gad, Asher. That's 11 of the 12 tribes. They're listed here in the order of the mothers that they are from. Reuven, Shimon, Levi, Yehuda, Yisachar, and Zevulun, the first six come from? Leah. Binyamin comes from? Rachel. Dan and Naphtali come from Bilha. Gad and Asher come from Zilpah. The one who is left out is?
Yosef.
Okay. And of course, because he was in Egypt, and he'll be mentioned presently. Vayihi kol nefesh yotzei yerech Yaakov shivim nefesh. And it was, all the souls that came from Yaakov were 70 souls. Vayosef hayav mitzvah. Yosef was in Egypt. Vayamas Yosef v'chol achav v'chol hador hahu. And Yosef died, and all his brothers and all of that generation. Uvnei Yisrael paru vayishritzu vayirbu vayatzmu v'maod maod. And the Jews were fruitful, and they multiplied. These are all different words for increasing. Let's see how they do it in English over here. I like to...
Fruitful teams increased and became strong.
I find it, it's impressive how they were able to come up with different words over here.
Them.
Right, fruitful teams increased and became strong. Very, very much. So some and the land became filled with them. Why does it refer to them as the ones who are coming to Egypt? These are the names of the Jewish people, Habayim Mitzrayimah, who are coming to Egypt. With Yaakov, each man and his household came. Why Habayim Mitzrayimah, that were coming to Egypt? They've already come to Egypt long ago. Remember that we are here, the Jews have come to Egypt, they have already settled in Egypt, they were already supported by Yosef, Yosef has already seen his grandchildren, etc., and then he died. Why does it say the ones who are coming to Egypt as if it's a present tense?
And they weren't accepted. They were seen as outsiders.
Okay, so you're suggesting that they were always the ones coming to Egypt, even after they got there.
They were still outsiders, no matter when it is. Jewish history, always outsiders. They were coming into a different part of a different program of Egypt now. But the author does, they were now entering another phase.
See, even when they're there physically, but they're still entering. They're still entering. They're still moving into a new phase.
Mm-hmm.
They're assimilating. Okay, so as time goes on, they're still entering the Egyptian culture. They haven't yet completely come to Egypt. They're not yet fully Egyptian. They're still in the process of entering Egypt. And it's with Yaakov, each man in his household came. Now, it lists the 12 tribes, and it tells us that there were 70 of souls. Now, as was mentioned, this was already said back in Parshas Vayigash, where the 70 souls were counted over there. And it tells us that Yosef was in Egypt. So why tell us again about the 70 souls? We know there were 70 souls. The Torah itself counted, and not only that, it did a better job there than it does here. Back there in Vayigash, it listed all 70, not just the 12 tribes, but their children, some of their grandchildren, are listed back in Parashas Vayigash. So why repeat over here the fact that there were 70? Why is that significant?
Maybe because Hashem fulfilled his promise that they're going to multiply and be fruitful, and they will come out a great nation.
Okay. Okay, so the Torah is emphasizing that they only started with 70. And then there was a population boom.
You know, originated from the 70, and it's emphasizing that.
Okay. Okay, so even though we had a significant increase in population once we reached Egypt, but we were really only expressions of those 70. Those 70 defined us when we came to Egypt.
It seems so strange to see already at that time we were at the translation of anti-Semitism.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that'll be the next. We haven't quite gotten to anti-Semitism yet. It's a little funny to call them anti... Well, no, we can call them anti-Semites.
The Jews are too dangerous to keep.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true.
And you go back all these years, nobody wanted us even then.
That's correct. That's correct.
And that's a good thing.
That's correct.
So they didn't want us.
But that's a good thing.
Better
than,
yeah.
But Joseph counted in that 70?
Yeah. He was counted along with his sons. Yeah. Now it says that Yosef and all his brothers and all of that generation died. This is important because the slavery does not begin in Egypt until all of the tribes die. Now I'll go through the years with you in a moment. We'll go through the years and how that works in just a moment. Let's first finish this up and then we'll talk about the years. And then it says that the Jews were very, very fruitful. Oh, and they had all these children. And the land became filled with them. So we know that Chazal tells us, sages tell us, it's a rather famous quote from Chazal, that the women had shisha bekeres echad. They had six in one delivery. One pregnancy, they would have six children. That's derived from the fact that the Torah uses here six words for increase. Now, the Hebrew words are paru, that's one, vayishritzu is two, vayirbu is three, vayasmu is four, bima'od is five, ma'od is six. So since it uses six words to describe the increase in population, we derive from there that it was shisha bekeres echad, six in one pregnancy, one delivery. What's that?
That comes up also in the Haggadah, doesn't it?
That's correct. Yeah. It's mentioned in the Haggadah. That's exactly right. Now, six tablets is wonderful, but we have to understand what that means, because although it is it's obviously a great bracha to have so many children at one time, but it presents significant challenges. I mean, you would imagine the infant mortality would have to be extremely high. Mm-hmm. Even today, that many children, it's rare to have it happen in the first place. But if it does happen, it's rare that they all live. And if they do live, there's often significant issues, physical, developmental issues, with that many children at one time. You know, twins is one thing, but once you get into, you know, multiple births, so then there can be significant issues. So what is the bracha over here of having so many children at one time? So it should be understood that when it says that they had six at one time, it wasn't simply they had six. They had six who were healthy, and they were able to care for the six. It wasn't simply, okay, here's six, and they'll be in the NICU for the next who knows how long. It was a bracha that they were healthy children, and that the mothers were able to care for that many children at once. It all went together. They were able to provide for them and care for them. It wasn't simply having six children and no means of support and no ability to take care of them and provide for their health. In the book of Shmuel, at one point in the book of Shmuel, it says that there was when they were moving the Aron, they were moving the Ark before the Beit HaMikdash was built. They were moving the Ark from one place to another, and the Ark stayed in a person's house named Oved Edom. And in his house there was a bracha, and it says that he merited having 54 children. Now what does it mean that he had 54 children? He already had eight sons who were all married. So there were eight married children of his. So there were eight daughters-in-law and his wife. So that's nine women in the family. All nine women had six at one time. That was a bracha that he had for housing the Aron, housing the Ark, for a certain amount of time over there in the book of Shmuel, the book of Samuel. So he ended up with 54 children. It means six of his own, and then he had another 48 grandchildren all at once. So can you imagine that not only do each of the daughters-in-law have six at a time, but their mother-in-law can't help them because she also had six at a time at the same time. So where's the, what's the bracha in that, right? What's the blessing in that? But it was a blessing because not only were they given the children, they were given the means to care for them and that they were healthy. It all goes together. It's not just simply six and then, deal with it. Mm-hmm. And that was the case here as well.
Is it because they had a lot of help?
Well, in this case,
the Jews were all helping each other?
I don't know.
How could they help each other?
They're all having babies. How could they help each other?
I don't know.
They had to have some kind of organization.
Now, there was a significant population boom. We know that when the Jews left Egypt, they left with 600,000 men between 20 and 60, which if you extrapolate out, if you assume the same amount of women at of that age, so that's now 600,000 plus 600,000 is 1.2 million. Assume boys and girls under the age of 20, that would probably be another 600,000. So you're up to 1.8 million, and then you got to take into account people over 60. So let's assume another 600,000. So you're talking about 2.5 million people starting with 70 souls. And it's 210 years later. So from 70 souls, they went to 2.5 million people in the span of 210 years. So that would not normally happen that quickly, but with the population boom, it happened. But it's even more dramatic than that, as we will see when we get to the actual exodus. Yeah?
Rabbi, I've heard this several times with Egyptian scholars making virtually no references to Jews. And is that...
The Egyptians were not happy with the historical records once we left Egypt, because they were smacked around, and it was not in the best interest of the national record to keep all the what went on over there. So the Egyptian record certainly is not trustworthy. That was not the way to be to preserve records of that nature. How do the years work out over here? Let's go through some of the years. I'll put it on the board if we can. I don't know if we have. Do you have any? You do? Oh, great, wonderful. Let's see.
You want to erase
that? Erase over here?
Yes,
to erase my beautiful apple. If you have something better, it would be better. Otherwise, I'll use. Let's try blue. Might be a little bit better. Yeah. Okay. All right. Let us start with the birth of the tribes. Now, we know that Yaakov went to Laban. Yaakov went to Laban's house, and he worked for 7 years before he married both Rachel and Leah. You recall that he married Leah. He wanted to marry Rachel, but it was switched. He married Leah. And then 1 week later, he married Rachel. And he worked for Rachel after he married her. He worked for Leah before he married her, 7 years, then married Leah, then married Rachel a week later, and worked 7 more years to pay for marrying the second wife. So they're having children already after the first 7 years that Yaakov is there. When Yaakov, let's use Yaakov's age, when Yaakov was 84 years old, that's when he marries both Rachel and Leah. Yaakov is 84. That's when he marries Rachel and Leah. And over the next 7 years, he has all of the tribes except for Binyamin. But they're all born over the next 7 years. So from 84 until Yaakov is 91, so he has 11 tribes who are born. 11 tribes are born.
Did you say that's like, I think, 35 and a half years now?
For Yaakov. I mean, it wasn't typically in those days, but for Yaakov, because he ended up living to be 147.
So the children is right, do they have more than one?
I don't know. Now, Yaakov lives to be 147. He comes down to Egypt when he is 130. When Yaakov is 130, then Yaakov comes to Egypt. Well, it's not just Yaakov, but that's when this is Yaakov's years. And when he's 130, that's when they come to Egypt. The Jews are in Egypt for 210 years. From the time that Yaakov comes to Egypt, they're there for another 210 years. Okay. Now, the the tribes that were born when Yaakov was between 84 and 91, Reuben, Shimon, Levi, Yehuda, etc. Now Levi is the third child born from Leah. So if he's the third child born from Leah, he could not have been born until at least the third year, because you've got to account for pregnancies. So even if Leah was having children one a year, even if that's what she was doing, it would be the third year before Levi would be born. So if he was 84 when he married Leah, and Reuben was born, that, let's say, 9 months later, or something along those lines, then it would be the next year that Shimon was born, when he was 85, and then when he's 86 or 87, somewhere in there is when Levi is born. So we're going to put down parenthetically, 86 or 87 is when Levi is born. Now, why do I mention the birth of Levi? Because Levi lives the longest of all the tribes. And when it says over here that they all died, that's telling us that the slavery did not begin until all the tribes had died. There was not one tribe left alive before when the slavery began. So if we know that Levi lived the longest, so if we add in Levi's years, then we will know approximately when the slavery began. Levi lived to be 137 years old. That's how old he lived to be. That is mentioned later on in the Chumash, that Levi lived to be 137. And so, we'll use 87 as our number. That Yaakov was 87 years old when Levi is born. Then they come down to Egypt and Yaakov is 130. So that is 43 years since Levi is born. So Levi is approximately 43 years old when they get to Egypt. So they come to Egypt. This is Levi's years. Levi is 43 when they come to Egypt, approximately. This is not 100% exactly, but it's about that. He's about 43 years old. Now, he lives to be 137. So Levi lives to be 137 years. Which is the death of Levi, which is when the slavery begins. So 137 minus 43, is from the time they came to Egypt, Levi's about 43, and he dies at 137. So the slavery doesn't begin for the first 94 years. The first 94 years that they're in Egypt, the slavery doesn't begin. And they're in Egypt for 210 years. So if we count, this is years in Egypt. Years in Egypt. If we count the years in Egypt, this would be year one. That's when they come to Egypt. So Levi dies, it's already year 94. So that if they're there for 210 years, how many more years are there left? There's 116 years left for their being in Egypt for slavery. So the slavery, the entire slavery is 116 years. That's how long the slavery is. So the Exodus is going to be at 210. I want to leave a space because we're going to put in something else. This is Exodus. So the entire slavery is 116 years. That's the entire slavery. However, as we will see as we read through, the slavery didn't happen in an instant. It's not that all of a sudden Paro woke up one day and said, okay, all Jews are slaves. It's very hard to do that, especially when you're dealing with millions of people. How do you subjugate them just in an instant? You can't do that. So we will see that Paro really had a diabolical plan, and he implemented it. And it was very premeditated, very thought out, and he slowly but surely enslaved the Jewish people. The process took 30 years. It was a 30-year process from the beginning of slavery until the slavery was complete. So it took the slavery's completion, when it was actually a full-fledged slavery, was when they were already in Egypt for 124 years. How do we know that? How do we know that it took 30 years before the slavery was complete?
because how many years does that leave for a total complete slavery? From year 124 to 210, that leaves 86 years. There's 86 years of total slavery. There's a person who is named for the slavery. Who was named for the slavery?
Anybody know? The hint is, it's a female.
Yocheved.
Not Yocheved. Miriam. Miriam, which comes from the word maror, bitter herbs, maror. Miriam was born, she was 86 at the time of the Exodus. Moshe was 80. Aaron is 3 years older than Moshe, he was 83. Miriam is 3 years older than Aaron, she's the oldest sister, she's 86. She was 6 years older than Moshe. The whole story of the birth of Moshe, when we get to it, Miriam is only 6 years old for that whole story. She's one of the midwives, etc. She's only 6 years old. She's 80, so she was 6 years old when Moshe was born. She was 86 at the Exodus. She was named Miriam because upon her birth, that's when the slavery became intense. That's when the slavery was complete, when now the Jews were full-fledged slaves, total slaves. So if we break it down, there were 94 years where the Jews were in Egypt and everything was calm. The tribes were still alive. There was no subjugation. There were 30 years where the subjugation began and became more intense, more intense, more intense, more intense. And finally, the last 86 years were when there was real intense slavery. So, we cannot get confused about how long was the slavery, all the terrible things that happened to the Jewish people. 86 years was a long time. That's more than a lifetime. That's a long time. But it was, quote-unquote, only 86 years. 86 years was the intense slavery that we went through. Yeah.
The firstborns were made trying to get rid of the babies. Was that already instated, the full-fledged slavery?
Yeah. When does that come into effect? That goes into effect when Moshe is supposed to be born. We'll get to that. We'll get to that. That's when Pharaoh is trying to prevent the birth of Moshe, the growth of Moshe. And we'll talk about that when we get there.
The slavery was already kicked in.
It was already kicked in. But not before that. He wouldn't have been able to implement that beforehand. So these are the years of the slavery. Miriam is named for it, and you can ask, why would you name someone for slavery? Isn't that a difficult name to carry around? We've talked about this before. Why would you name someone for the bitterness? Why would you saddle a child with a name like that? Well, I obviously remember, but why would you do that to your child?
Okay. That's reference. She's going to be, she's...
Her essence is bitter?
No. To bring us out of the bitterness. It's through her that Moshe is going to be born.
Okay. So we're going to get to this. We're going to discuss, very good, we're going to discuss Miriam and the circumstances around her birth and then the birth of her brothers Aaron and Moshe and how she plays a role and what she represents. But she is named Miriam is for Maror, is for the bitterness. And that's the 86 years of slavery. It is during that time, it is during these 116 years that the population explodes. So although they were there for 210 years, it's really only during the latter part of it that there is a population explosion. It begins before the 116 years because that's really what Pharaoh is reacting to when he wants to put the slavery into effect because the Jews have become so populous. But the bulk of it is in the latter half of this equation. So those are your years for the slavery. Yeah, I think more than just try to kill the children. All right, so we will discuss this. The truth is that children being born was in itself miraculous because when people are so overworked, they are really not physically capable of procreating. And so even that was in itself. That's really the Egyptians did take the steps necessary to prevent future generations of Jews. Now, but bear in mind that their intent was not to wipe us out because we were cheap labor. They liked having the Jews as slaves.
They weren't intent on wiping us out. They were not like the Germans. They wanted us as slaves. That's what they wanted. And they got that. But what, as we'll see later, when they were actually killing Jewish babies, that was because of a particular fear of the birth of Moshe, which was impending. But it was not their intention to wipe out the Jewish people. As is always the case, it was the population boom that brought about the hatred of the Egyptians, or the fear of the Egyptians, of the Jewish people. As long as we Jews keep a low profile and we're not in your face of the people who were around, then we don't have anger directed towards us most of the time. It's when the Jews are everywhere and they appear to be running the country, that's what creates the anti-Semitism, that's what creates the hatred and the fear and the anger. We can't control the fact that we exist. We do exist. And if Hashem gives us a bracha that there are a lot of us, we can't control that either. That's a good thing. It's not a bad thing that there should be a lot of us. On the other hand, what we can control is whether we keep a low profile or whether we are very visible. And it would behoove us, when we are not on our own land and we are in a foreign country, that we keep as low a profile as we possibly can. We can't keep a completely low profile because Hashem wants us to be noticed. Because when we're noticed, He's noticed. And He wants that. That's our job in this world. But as long as we Jews can avoid the spotlight, it would be preferable if we did. It's not never a good thing for Jewish people to be visible and so obvious. It would be great if all of us behaved the way we should. Then we would be that light unto the nations. But since, unfortunately, many of us do not behave as we should, that's what gets highlighted. And when that happens, it reflects on all the Jewish people. Mm-hmm. And that's a real dangerous thing. Okay, so this is the introduction to the book of Shemos. We're a few minutes early, but we're gonna stop here. This is the introduction. And please God, starting next week, we will begin with Pasuk Ches, verse 8. We'll move a little bit more quickly than we did tonight. But now we have the background necessary for the book of Shemos.